Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluk, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
It's extremely disappointing. The recommendation is short-sighted. It focuses too narrowly on construction productivity without consideration of the long-term social and economic cost of inaccessible housing.
The Queensland's Productivity Commission recommends to opt out a standard which supports Australians with an accessibility issue. We have all the details. Also, what conservation efforts are needed for Antarctica to be protected from future threats? And later today...
When I had my admission interview, they now do pre-admission interviews for all of the students when they start. But 25 years ago, I was the only one.
We spoke with the first profoundly deaf person who works as a veterinarian. What was his journey like? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, the Northwest Shelf Gas Project and its impacts on the Mujururga Aboriginal rock art is being challenged in the courts. Friends of the Australian Rock Art, or FARA for short, went to the Supreme Court this morning to reinforce the importance the rock art has on First Nations culture, as well as its showcase of human history, and why it should be protected from further pollution damage. Co-conveners from FARA, Judith Hugo and Sue Swain, spoke with The Wire's Zachary Probert before the court's decision to further discuss the case.
Mujururga is in WA's Pilbara, contains the oldest and largest rock art gallery in the world. Estimated to be close to 50,000 years old, remembering that Lascaux is only 18,000 years old, and the pyramids in Stonehenge between 3,000 and 4,000 years old. These petroglyphs, which are carved engravings on the rock art surface, contain images of prehistoric and extinct animals like the thylacine and the earliest known depictions of the human face on the planet, known as archaic faces. In fact, this is the earliest record of mankind's survival through various climate changes, and the carving of images only ceased after colonization and the tragic massacre of the Yubarara people in the Flying Fern massacre of 1868. In fact, this rock art gallery is so significant that it was recently awarded World Heritage status by UNESCO.
Well, speaking on the World Heritage, if it has been granted that, why is it that plans like the gas project have been extended and have been approved for the area?
I would like to say that the Rock Art Gallery was recently given World Heritage listing. The recommendation by ICOMOS, who assessed whether or not it should receive World Heritage listing, had three conditions for the rock art to protect it. Number one, no new industry on the Burrup, and this includes the Northwest Shelf Project and Perdaman. Number two, no more emissions allowed. Clean up the air from the existing industry that's already on the Burrup. And three, rehabilitate the entire Burrup back to its original natural state prior to industrial development. All these three conditions were scrapped by the UNESCO review panel, and without this protection, the Petroglyph Gallery will continue to deteriorate until there is nothing left, erasing the most significant continuous record of mankind's existence on the planet.
And now I understand that your organization is going to the Supreme Court to challenge the gas project and try and protect this area. So what can you talk to me about how you plan to challenge this in the court, what you hope to achieve out of this, and hopefully what this can lead to in future situations like this?
We were formed back in 2006, and we've been fighting ever since then, to protect, preserve, and promote the world unique rock art of Mujururga. We're particularly alarmed that the Northwest Shelf Joint Venture Plant, which is due to close in 2030, has requested an extension of its operation until 2070, with no specific plans to reduce its emissions. This was granted by the WA Environment Minister in December 24, and it's the validity of this decision that Farah is challenging in court. We feel that the decision maker did not properly follow the requirements of the Environmental Protection Act, and the state assessment failed to consider the impact of climate change that would result from the project, including Scope 3 emissions, on the environment, which includes the Murujuga rock art landscape.
How are you hoping to get this change through the courts in a judicial manner? And what do you think your chances of success are?
Well, we can't really predict that, but we feel that after countless submissions and appeals over the years that have been ignored by the WA government, we hope that at last judicial action will hold decision makers to account and ensure the proper consideration of the impacts of industrial expansion on the natural environment, including this outstanding cultural site. But the WA government has to be brave enough to stand up to its fossil fuel masters, and despite their complaints about expense of perhaps installing emission reduction technology, the government has to insist that they abide by the environmental principle of polluter pays.
Judith Hugo and Sue Swain from Farah there, speaking with The Wire's Zachary Probert.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
This week, the Queensland's Productivity Commission is pushing to opt out of the National Construction Code's Livable Housing Design Standard. The standard allows Australians with a disability and with an accessibility need to add simple features for a better quality of life and improve safety. Advocates and organisations are concerned this recommendation will set Queensland a step backwards for accessibility. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Chief Operating Officer of sporting wheelies and wheelchair user Dane Cross, what's the aim of the standard?
The Livable Housing Design Standard is a set of minimum accessibility features that are required for all new homes that are built under the National Construction Code. So we're talking about practical, common sense things like step-free entries, wider internal doorways and hallways, and reinforced walls in the bathroom so that we can allow for future grab rail installation. These features, they make homes safer and easier for people to live in, not just for people with disability, but for aging Australians, parents with prams, and anyone recovering from an injury. So it's about building homes that meet people's needs across their entire life.
The Queensland Productivity Commission has recommended to opt out of this standard. What are your initial thoughts on this?
Look, it's extremely disappointing. The recommendation is short-sighted. It focuses too narrowly on construction productivity without consideration of the long-term social and economic cost of inaccessible housing. It hasn't taken into consideration the things like avoidable hospitalizations, falls, premature admissions into aged care. Choosing not to adopt this standard, it basically ignores the lived realities of thousands of Queenslanders. It risks putting Queensland out of step with other states, and at a national level, we've seen the National Disability Strategy adopt an action plan around accessible housing. So it's just going in the wrong direction.
So you just mentioned earlier about a little bit of what the standard is and some of the tasks that are included in the standard for benefiting, Australians with disabilities or someone who needs more accessibility at home. How is this standard improving the lives of Queenslanders who need more accessibility here at home?
Basically, it improves independence and improves dignity. For a person with mobility challenges, being able to enter their own home without assistance or safely access the bathroom or navigate with a wheelchair or walker, it's not a luxury, it's a necessity. These standards help reduce the need for paid care, so things like the NDIS, and it keeps people out of hospitals. And as I mentioned earlier, it allows people to remain in their homes longer. As a wheelchair user myself, I have witnessed and experienced firsthand the benefits that accessible housing can bring to an individual. Having an accessible home really creates that base from which someone with disability can launch from and engage with employment, engage with community.
If the standard is removed in Queensland, what are the consequences we may see in houses across the state, and how will Queensland be compared with other states in this matter?
We know that the uptake across Australia has been mixed. I know that New South Wales and Western Australia have already or haven't adopted the minimum standards when it was first rolled out in October 2023. But this move this recommendation by the Queensland Productivity Commission would put Queensland behind the eight ball. Now, if we walk away from this, we'll be building homes that are obsolete by the day the keys are handed over. It will mean fewer homes that are suitable for people with disability. There'll be more retrofitting at far higher cost. And, there's a growing housing crisis in Queensland. And for those who can't find a home that suits their need, this just exacerbates that. So, we have seen other states, Victoria, Tasmania, embracing these standards. So it would mean that Queensland would be left behind and out of step with national expectations, community values, and the direction of the federal investment.
What is Sporting Wheelies doing to advocate the opposition to removing this standard? And what can the community do to be, to support you on this issue?
Well, Sporting Wheelies and Spinal Life Australia, we're actively engaging, obviously, with media, policymakers, and the public to make sure that this issue doesn't fly under the radar. We've shared evidence. Accessible housing is economically smart. The community can help by speaking up. Email your MP, share your story, support organisations like ours that are pushing against this recommendation.
That was Dane Cross from Sporting Wheelies, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Armidale on Tune FM, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. As Antarctica faces growing conservation threats, a new report calls for a coordinated effort to protect the continent. With experts from over 40 countries involved, the report identified 10 major challenges, categorized as either environmental or geopolitical, which hovers over Antarctica's future. I spoke to research fellow from the Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future Program, Dr. Zachary Carter, to learn more.
So this report was commissioned as a decadal update to an original Horizon Scan study that was obviously conducted over 10 years ago. So we wanted to take a look at what challenges are facing the Antarctic region in terms of conservation. And we wanted to compare those with what was identified previously and with what's been coming up and emerging now. So our study brought together 131 experts to sort of pinpoint the most pressing emerging conservation threats that are facing Antarctica and the Southern Ocean. And so we used something called horizon scanning, which is a structured way of bringing experts together to identify emerging issues before they escalate. And we identified 10 key challenges. So this includes things from extreme weather events to changes in environmental protection policies, geopolitical instability, and even novel diseases. And many of these threats that we identified sit outside of the Antarctic Treaty System's traditional remit. So the Antarctic Treaty System is the governance regime for the Antarctic region. And this highlights both the vulnerabilities of the Antarctic region, but also opportunities for reform. And so by anticipating the challenges now, we can give policymakers and conservationists the insights they need to strengthen the protection of one of the planet's most critical and fragile ecosystems.
Zach, also noticed in the report, you mentioned something about iceberg harvesting and agricultural expansion, especially the second point. I wouldn't put Antarctic and agriculture two together in a normal circumstance. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. So I'll start kind of with iceberg harvesting. And this really exemplifies, it is a bit of a wacky idea seemingly right now, but it sort of exemplifies one of the main issues that we found. It's that many of the challenges we identified fall into sort of similar broad categories that were actually highlighted over a decade ago. So iceberg harvesting sits in with this resource exploitation and economic interest category, so along things with hydrocarbon exploration, bioprospecting, or mineral extraction. And so this tells us something that's really important. The drivers that are shaping Antarctic conservation are not going away. They're persistent, and in many cases, they're just taking on new forms. So iceberg harvesting, as a good example, sounds really novel, but it's just another expression of the same long-standing interest in exploiting Antarctic resources.
I understand like all these issues that the report is looking at, they're all very, very important. Would you say at the moment climate change, would it be considered the most pressing issue, or is it maybe the geopolitical landscape that we're in?
So climate change is always a perennial issue for the Antarctic region, but something that novel that we identified was an entirely new group of threat. We call these global disruptions. So these are large-scale events that originate outside Antarctica, ripple into the region, and they can undermine science, governance, and conservation. So this includes things like war among treaty parties or large-scale epidemics or pandemics. So things that we've already seen. What's very important about these is these exist beyond the remit of the Antarctic governance regime. So things that are happening at home are having an impact all the way down at the bottom of the world in Antarctica. There's not much that we can do there at the bottom to actually address them without major reforms to the governance regime itself. And so this goes also for with climate change, where this threat is emerging from around the world outside the region, but is increasingly having an impact and making itself known in the Antarctic region.
Do you think there is some misconceptions by people out there about Antarctica?
Yeah, so we think of Antarctica as being cast away at the bottom of the world, isolated away from the rest of the world. But really, it's often referred to as the heart beat of the planet because it affects so many different processes, including ocean circulation and as well as the atmosphere and obviously temperature. So conserving the Antarctic is incredibly important for everywhere else on the world. So considering it out of sight, out of mind, might not be the best choice moving forward. I think we probably need to be considering Antarctica much more heavily in terms of conservation planning.
Going into the future, in terms of addressing the issues and talking about the report, like how should the structural vulnerability in the governance be addressed?
That's a very hard thing to answer, and that's something that we are only just beginning to tackle. We sort of point to it with this research, but we suggest that there might need to be a critical reassessment of how the governance system manages its conservation threats. So this could mean strengthening its capacity to address external drivers directly or aligning them more closely with international frameworks that are better equipped to handle global and cross-jurisdictional challenges.
That was research fellow from the Securing Antarctica's Environmental Future Program, Dr. Zachary Carter. Australians with a disability face challenges depending on the condition, but it will never let them stop on achieving positive outcomes. Dr. Alex Harrison is the first profoundly deaf person to graduate from veterinary school in Australia. He graduated 5 years ago. With his unique experiences at university, he's also advocating for this community sector. Powered Media's Emma Myers spoke with Dr. Alex Harrison to find out more about his journey.
I've been a vet for 25 years, and I was a partner in a group of clinics for 10 years.
What unique challenges did you face during your time at university.
When I had my admission interview, they now do pre-admission interviews for all of the students when I start. But 25 years ago, I was the only one. And they did ask me how I would cope with some safety concerns, like coping with 10 horses in an enclosure. And would I hear people trying to warn me? And I told them that I was a rugby player, that I was used to lots of people being around me. And I think they took that on board. When I was there, some of the challenges I had was how to take notes, because when I'm in lectures, I had to lip-read. But when you're lip-reading, it's very hard to write at the same time. So the way that we worked that out was to pay for one of my colleagues to take notes so I could copy them from her. And it meant that I wouldn't miss things. Nowadays, when I go to conferences, I could take photos on my iPhone. But we didn't have them back then. I made my own see-through surgical mask by putting a clear see-through material in the window so that I could look through it through that. And I used to have to make them by hand. It could take me 2 or 3 hours every week to make them. They weren't commercially available back then. I have a special stethoscope that will convert the sound waves into a visual format so that I could see the house sounds on the screen. And I had to learn how to read that when no one else could really teach me that.
Was there a period where you were getting knocked back from jobs because of your disability?
Absolutely. It meant that some employers were self-selecting themselves out, which was both good and bad. It kind of meant, though, that I wasn't wasting my time with some employers. I think because I was the first profoundly deaf vet in Australia at the time to graduate from university, I almost had to imagine myself into being as a deaf professional, I suppose. And my peers and my clients didn't always quite know how to deal with it. For the most part, a lot of them were supportive, although there were some things that weren't completely inclusive. One of my biggest problems was around the telephone and how I was going to cope on the telephone. Back in those days, you often needed a special phone line to use them, and you needed to be in a separate room. And then you could set me up in the staff room, but then the staff room would be noisy. Then they put me in a quiet room, but a quiet room was actually a euthanasia room, and I had no computer. And so I would have to walk outside the room to look at the patient's notes and the blood results, or make up an estimate for the client, and then have to come back in. So sometimes some of the earlier employers were trying to be inclusive, but didn't know how to. So I had to learn how to advocate and innovate and develop new ways of doing things.
How do you manage the standard veterinary checkup procedure?
I usually start by introducing myself. I say my name. I tell people that I look good. Then most clients generally won't miss a beat. Occasionally you get some that do. I explain what my needs are, but don't make a big deal out of it. I just explain it matter-of-factly, and then I move on and focus on the pet. And I use a visual stethoscope to listen to the shifts and the half sounds. If I'm in a consult with multiple people, I try to get them to slow down and focus on one person talking at a time. So often it's less to do with the actual physical domination and more to do with how I manage or communicate with the clients.
And how did you become an advocate for people with disability in the veterinary profession?
I was a partner for 10 years and I was working 60-hour week. And I was trying to learn all the skills and techniques that I could. But I was trying to prove myself so much, I burnt out. I actually fell asleep at the wheel one day with my wife and my two daughters in the car and crashed into a telephone pole. And in the aftermath of that, I realised that I had to do something about that, and I nearly walked away from the vet profession. But then I realised I had internalised ableism, and that internalised ableism was making me try to prove myself so much. And then I started talking to other people and realising there were so many vets and vet nurses who were also dealing with disability, chronic illness, neurodivergence, and they were feeling alone.
Veterinarian Dr. Alex Harrison there. speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company. We'll see you next time on The Wire.